That he was supposed to sing on Smothers Brothers, but the network stopped that song from being played. Ultimately, though, he was able to sing it there.
It took a while. What happened is that they cut away from Pete Seeger playing the banjo. Next thing you knew, he came back with the 12-string guitar. They made the edit a little awkward, so everybody would kind of know, I rather suspect, and Pete suspected too, that there had been some break there. There had been some change. Someone had gone in and cut something out. Eventually, yes, the next time, next year, times had changed. It was late in the 1960s during the protests against the Vietnam War. That song, Waist Deep in the Big Muddy, was an obvious allegory there. He got to sing the song.
We have to leave it there. But I want to thank you for being with us. David King Dunaway has made three major documentaries about Pete Seeger, historian and radio host. This is Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks so much for joining us.
The time is 5 o'clock. You're listening to KBOO Portland. Coming up next is the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned.
Tune into KBOO every weekday at 7 p.m. for Hard Knock Radio, news and views from a hip-hop perspective with Davey D. Hard Knock Radio features in-depth interviews and profiles with community leaders, activists, hip-hop artists, and musicians, giving voice to community concerns and offering a unique forum to explore issues relevant to hip-hop community. That's every weekday at 7 p.m. here on your community radio station, KBOO Portland.
Are you still looking for a way to fit KBOO into your year-end giving? KBOO Community Radio is in this year's Willamette Week Give Guide. For the past 11 years, the Give Guide has raised nearly $13 million for hundreds of local nonprofits. Help us reach our $20,000 goal and look KBOO up on the giveguide.org website and make a donation today before December 31st. Remember, we have a one-to-one match for all new and increasing donations, too. Thank you for supporting KBOO.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, Portland's Know Your City trips over finance but continues to lead tours in 2016.
Klamath Water Basin Agreement falls short of communal and congressional approval.
And a Portland band, The Slants, gets federal approval to trademark their name.
Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News. For Tuesday, December 21st, 2015, I'm Robert Barncourt.
And I'm Jared Dantzler. A Waller County, Texas grand jury has decided not to charge any of the officers who were involved in the death of Sandra Bland in the county jail last summer. Bland was stopped by police in July, allegedly for making an illegal lane change. The stop escalated quickly, with Trooper Brian Encinia pulling his stun gun out and ordering Bland out of the car. She was taken to the county jail in handcuffs. Unable to pay $500 bail, Bland remained in jail for 3 days when she was found dead in her cell. Jail officials called her death a suicide, claiming that she had hanged herself with a garbage bag. But activists with the Black Lives Matter movement believe that Bland was killed while in custody. Bland had been an active organizer against police brutality and violence. Sandra Bland's mother, Geneva Reed Veal, has filed a wrongful death lawsuit in federal court against the trooper, two jail employees, and the Texas Department of Public Safety. A trial date of January 2017 has been set for that lawsuit. But as for criminal charges against the jail by the state, Direct District Attorney, today's grand jury decision has essentially ruled out any possibility.
A Black Lives Matter protest scheduled for tomorrow in Minneapolis at the Mall of America will be allowed to go forward as planned. Hennepin County Judge Karen Janish today denied a request by Mall of America to have a restraining order issued to prevent activists from demonstrating. The mall is private property, and courts in Minnesota, unlike some other states, have not held that large malls are public spaces with free speech protection. So mall operators still have the right to have protesters charged with trespass and removed from the property. A Black Lives Matter demonstration last year at the Mall of America ended up with several protesters arrested for trespass. Charges against 11 of the protesters were thrown out in November, and another 17 had their charges kept in place. In today's ruling, Judge Janish did issue a restraining order against three named individuals who are some of the organizers for Wednesday's demonstration.
A U.S. federal court decided today that The Slants, a Portland-based Asian American band, has the right to trademark its name. The court said parts of a 1946 law barring the Patent and Trademark Office from registering, quote, disparaging names, are unconstitutional because they intrude on the private expression of free speech. In a 110-page set of opinions, the court held that the government cannot refuse to register trademarks because it disapproves of the expressive messages conveyed. Simon Tam, the bassist and founder of The Slants, named the band in part to be a reappropriate, a word that has long been seen as a racial slur targeting Asians. The court cited other slur-containing names that had been registered by the Patent Office, calling the office's decision, quote, seemingly arbitrary. The ruling further states that the First Amendment forbids government regulators to deny registration because they find the trademarks likely to offend others. After a six-year-long battle with the Patent Office, Tam called the decision the best present ever on Twitter.
The Center for Biological Diversity has filed a lawsuit against the U.S. Bureau of Reclamation over harm done to the federally protected Oregon spotted frog. This harm has been caused by operation of the Crane Prairie and Wickiup dams on the Deschutes River. The 2 to 4 inch long black spotted frog, which was protected only last year under the Endangered Species Act, was once very common from British Columbia down to Northern California along numerous rivers and lakes, and now the frog has undergone massive declines and is only known to fewer than 100 sites. KABU reporter Doug McVeigh spoke with Noah Greenwald, Endangered Species Director for the Center for Biological Diversity.
The Oregon spotted frog is a species that used to occur all across the western half of Oregon in wetlands, and it's lost about 90% of its habitat and populations with loss of wetlands, channelization of rivers, damming of rivers, livestock grazing, other things that we do that are harmful to rivers. Some of the last surviving populations occur on the Deschutes River, on the margins of both reservoirs, both the Crane Prairie and Wickiup Dam reservoirs. They live on the margins of those, as well as along the river proper below the dams. And so in the process of operating those dams to provide irrigation water, the Bureau of Reclamation harms frog populations by either raising or lowering the reservoirs too much, too fast, or raising and lowering the levels of the river too much or too fast. So particularly in the spring when the frogs spawn and their egg masses are in shallow water, which is what they like. They like the shallow water along the edges of rivers or in back channels or around along the edges of lakes. And so we've sued them because the Oregon spotted frog is a listed species under the Endangered Species Act. It's a threatened species. And we've sued them to consult with Fish and Wildlife Service and ensure that their actions don't unduly harm the frog.
So now the Bureau of Reclamation's operation of the dams, are they hurting other species besides the frog?
Well, so the way that those dams are managed basically turns the normal flow, what they call the hydrograph of the Deschutes River, on its head. So instead of, you know, having high flows in the spring that decline during the late summer to lower flows and then kind of come back up in the winter. The river is they basically hold back all the winter and spring floods for irrigation, which are then released late in the summer. So instead of having a peak flow in the spring, you have a peak flow later in the summer and you know, really low flows in the wintertime when there's, you know, normally a lot of rain and stuff. So, yeah, it's definitely harmful to the health of the river and harmful to fish, to steelhead and salmon as well.
All right, Noah, any closing thoughts for the listeners, and where can people find out more about the center's work and about your suit?
Sure. A great place for information with the center is our website, biologicaldiversity.org, is a great place to look. And then, you know, I'd say, you know, again, that the loss of the Oregon spotted frog, I mean, it used to be all over the Willamette Valley, for example, and in Portland as well, but no longer. You know, so goes the Oregon spotted frog, so goes our wetlands, you know, which provided habitat for hundreds to thousands of species, birds, et cetera, and provided flood protection and water filtration as well. So we've lost a lot of wetlands, and that's why the Oregon spotted frog is in such big trouble and why, you know, we need to be careful with those last few places that it occurs.
All right, well, I've been speaking with Noah Greenwald. He is the Endangered Species Director at the Center for Biological Diversity. They're at biologicaldiversity.org. Noah, thank you so much.
Thanks, Doug. Take care.
You too. This is Doug McVeigh with KBOO News.
On January 1st, a law will go into place assigning certain protections and benefits to domestic workers in the state of Oregon. The law is called the Domestic Workers Bill of Rights. For more, I spoke with an expert on household labor and taxes. Tom Breedlove is a director for HomePay, a division of the website care.com. This is Jared Dantzler for KBOO News. I'm here speaking with Tom Breedlove, a director at HomePay, a division of care.com. Welcome, Tom.
Thank you very much.
And we're talking about the Domestic Workers Bill of Rights. And I'm wondering, Tom, if you can sum up in your words, what is the Domestic Workers Bill of Rights?
The Domestic Worker Bill of Rights is really just a package of protections and benefits for household employees, particularly nannies, house cleaners, housekeepers. And Oregon is the fifth state in the union to adopt such a law, and behind New York, Hawaii, California, and Massachusetts. And really, it's designed to give these fairly low-wage workers some very basic protections.
What types of who qualifies as employers under this bill?
Well, it would be if a family has a nanny or a housekeeper working in their home who's not a parent or a child of theirs. It also excludes casual babysitting. So if a family just has a, you know, babysitter on a Friday night occasionally, that they wouldn't fall under this law. So it's really a regular nanny or housekeeper who works for a family.
So I'm curious, does that fall under a certain number of hours or a certain pay grade?
No, there's no stipulation based on pay or number of hours worked. It's just if it's a regular worker in the home. So sporadic, you know, like I said, casual babysitting would be exempt, but any other ongoing type of relationship would be considered an employment relationship.
And what types of tax-related or healthcare-related benefits will this provide for domestic workers, nannies, and such?
Well, the benefits, there's really five of them. The first is that they are entitled to 24 hours off each week, so they get a day of rest each week. And if they do need to work on that seventh day of the week, then they have to be paid overtime. So it's really just making sure they have a day of rest. If they average 30 hours a week or more, then they would be entitled to 3 paid days off each year, so 3 days of paid vacation. And a lot of families already offer that for their worker. But for those that don't, that will be a new stipulation in the law. Then for live-in workers, they must be paid overtime for any hours they work beyond 44 in a work week. So they have to be paid at time and a half if they cross 44 hours in any seven-day period. And they also, those live-in workers also have to be given 8 hours off each night to get some sleep, or 8 hours off each day, I should say, to get some sleep, and they need adequate sleeping facilities. And then the fifth provision is really just that they are now formally protected under state sexual harassment laws in Oregon.
How will states like New York, Hawaii, Oregon, the places that have passed measures like this, how will they keep track of all the domestic workers? How will this be regulated, so to speak?
Well, it's really regulated like any other law, in the sense that you know, an employer is responsible for making sure that these benefits are given to the worker, and if the family in this case doesn't abide by the law, then they if they are discovered, you know, through a wage dispute, or if the government were to find out about it, then they would be penalized and fined for this. And typically the way it would work is probably a former disgruntled employee would file a dispute of some sort, and that would bring it to the attention of the government, and then the family would then get assessed penalties.
Any questions or comments to folks that this will affect in the new year? I'm actually a nanny myself, but I would fall under the casual kind of 1 day a week babysitting nanny, so this wouldn't affect me. But for folks, this will affect. Any advice, tax wise, or any tips looking forward to 2016?
Yeah, I think, you know, the best advice, I think, is to, if you're the family, make sure you understand the obligations. And you know, at Care.com homepage, we talk to families and help them understand the law. And there are some nuances depending on situations. So, you know, we offer free consultations. I would advise them to talk to someone like us who can help them understand the law, and then sit down with the worker and make sure that the worker understands the law. And I would, you know, I would highly suggest to all your listeners that they have a contract, an employment agreement. We do provide a template and provide guidance on how to do that. But having that in writing, where everybody knows exactly what benefits are going to be offered, and that everyone understands that we're complying. You know, I think that's pretty fundamental, but it's real important to making sure that the working relationship is on solid ground. So your listeners can call us or go to myhomepay, myhomepay.com. You know, we see it as a really important step in the professionalization of the industry. A lot of these workers have been kind of historically underpaid and have had very few safety nets, really. This kind of gives them some basic protections that we feel like all professionals deserve and most Americans already have. So this is pretty basic, and we think it's a really good thing for the industry.
Again, I've been speaking with Tom Breedlove, a business development director for HomePay at myhomepay.com. That's a division of care.com. Thank you so much, Tom, for joining us.
Thank you very much, Jared. Appreciate you having me.
For KBOO News, I'm Jared Dantzler.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned after this newscast for an interview with Jim McCarthy of Oregon Water Watch and Tom Schlossen, who is an attorney for the Hoopa Valley Tribe, about the state of the Klamath Basin agreements and associated water rights. This will be followed by The F Word, a feminist media collective, at 6 o'clock. And at 7 o'clock, it'll be Hard Knock Radio News and Views from a hip-hop perspective. Tomorrow's weather is going to be showers and thundershowers. The high will be about 44 with an insignificant low. The sun is going to set at the earliest time this year, 4:32 p.m. on the shortest day of the year. Today in history, the Soviet Union ended itself, and 11 former republics announced that they represented the Commonwealth. This left President Mikhail Gorbachev an emperor without an empire. Also today in 2010, President Obama repealed the Don't Ask, Don't Tell policy, which had required gay service members to stay in the closet if they wanted to stay in the military. The quote for today is from our own news and public affairs director, Janke Soderberg, who says, "The less time you have until deadline, the more things go wrong."
Know Your City is a Portland nonprofit which for 6 years has led informational tours guiding participants through the city's historic peoples and places. The organization has shifted from paid staff to all volunteer run in the wake of financial mismanagement by its former leadership. For more, KBOO's Kristen Yunt spoke with Know Your City's executive director, Cameron Witten, about the recent near fall from grace and aspirations for the new year.
Know Your City. We are a local nonprofit that was founded in June of 2009. Our mission is about civic and artistic empowerment in this community. We do this by leveraging the creative faculties of the people around us. We do tours, lectures, publications, youth programs, and other creative projects that connect people to this place. And we do it in a way that uplifts the voices of social justice, uplift the voices of marginalized communities, marginalized people, and really helping all people, all Oregonians in our region have a stronger understanding of the totality of our experiences. And so, you know Your City recently began a leadership transition. I became executive director of Know Your City 7 weeks ago. My first day was November 4th. And previously, to me coming as executive director, Know Your City had to have an emergency board meeting, and there was a tough decision to be made about whether or not Know Your City would have to close immediately. And I decided, as somebody who's been involved with the organization since November of 2012, I've seen the value in its work. I was first asked to speak on a tour about homelessness after I did my 55-day hunger strike. And shortly after that, I became a member, and then after that, became a board member in May of 2013 and became board president in January of 2014. And so I've seen a lot in the organization over the past couple of years. And you know, I know that right now, Know Your City is in a tough time. There was issues of financial mismanagement that happened within former organizational leadership. And I decided at this time that I would become an executive director and do this unpaid and find a way to make sure that Know Your City can keep its vital projects happening in 2016. We've made many steps since that decision to transform this organization so it is transparent. You know, our mission is about truth. It's about justice. And we wanted to make sure that the community knew why we were going through these changes. And so we sent out a press release. We sent out an email yesterday letting people know what had happened to the organization. And now we've launched a crowdfunding campaign on Indiegogo. It's called It's a Wonderful Life, Save Know Your City. You can find it on our Twitter. Our Twitter handle is KYCPDX. And we are going to the community saying that our goal is to raise $12,000 by the end of the year, and that $12,000 will really allow us to build that strong momentum that we need to do all of our work in 2016.
So are you able to say what the nature of the financial mismanagement was?
It's a personal issue that our organization is still investigating. We've taken swift action to make sure that the problems do not continue, but we are still exploring all of our options to make sure that those who are responsible are held accountable.
So it sounds like you've made a move from having paid staff to going, are you completely volunteer now?
We are completely volunteer.
Do you find that not having paid staff is more in line with the goals and philosophy of Know Your City?
So, you know, I'm currently still finishing up my bachelor's degree at Portland State University.
Right now it's a volunteer-led organization, and I do believe it will continue to be a volunteer-led organization, but with paid staff in the future to help things move along efficiently, right?
Yeah.
You kind of gave a good overview of Know Your City, but what are some of the recent things that Know Your City has taken on?
Know Your City is really important as Portland is having these conversations about our future. I would say looking at the civic climate of our community, there are so many more discussions happening now around very important social justice issues, whether it's Black Lives Matter, the climate crisis, affordable housing. People are paying attention more now than ever. And Know Your City's track record has been within bringing diverse groups of people together, working with over 90 different community organizations the past 6 years, and helping us to tell stories that shift the narrative of human rights in our region. And so Know Your City is committed to continue doing that work in 2016. We've already had a lot of great programs and activities happening in December. We have a lot planned for January. January is going to be a really big year for us.
Can you give us a hint? I know that it's a civic-minded organization. Can you give us a hint about what the campaign is?
So it's going to be a political campaign, and we're going to be creating a list of demands that will allow Know Your City to work with community members, teachers, and students so that we can actually bring truth and justice to our educational process when we talk about Oregon studies.
So you say that you are kicking off a political campaign. Does that mean that you're a 501c4 or you're a 501c3?
We are a 501c3, like hiring lobbyists or anything. And it's really, we are organizing in the community.
So this is Cameron Whitten, and we're talking about the Know Your City in a bit of a jam here. They were thinking about closing their doors, but instead went to a volunteer-led organization to try to save money, and they are asking people in the city to support the nonprofit, and that's Know Your City. And thank you so much for speaking with us today, Cameron.
Thank you, Kristen.
The new governor of Kentucky, Matt Bevin, issued an executive order today changing the state's marriage license. Marriage licenses in Kentucky had included the name of the county clerk for the county in which the license was issued. Earlier this year, Rowan County Clerk Kim Davis sparked controversy by refusing to sign the marriage licenses of same-sex couples, citing her religious beliefs as the reason. Governor Bevin's order means that county clerks in Kentucky will no longer be able to stand in the way of people who simply wish to be wed. Bevin cast the order as protection of religious freedom. He said it was, quote, to ensure that the sincerely held religious beliefs of all Kentuckians are honored. Another executive order issued today is going to repeal an order by Bevin's predecessor, which had restored voting rights to more than 14,000 people in Kentucky who had been convicted and had already served their time in prison. Bevin's order effectively means that people in Kentucky who have a felony record of any kind can only have their rights restored through a pardon from the governor.
Six U.S. soldiers were killed on Monday when a suicide bomber on a motorcycle struck their patrol. The incident occurred near the Bagram Air Base, about 25 miles north of Kabul. Bagram is one of the main bases in Afghanistan for the nearly 10,000 U.S. troops still in the country. One of the six dead American soldiers was Major Adriana Vorderbruggen, the first openly gay woman to be killed in action in Afghanistan. Her partner, Heather, and their son, Jacob, live near Washington, D.C. In other Afghanistan news, Taliban forces have taken large parts of the southern province of Helmand following a month-long offensive. That's several months long. Yesterday, the Taliban attacked the police headquarters in Sangin, a town in Helmand province known for opium production, but an airstrike prevented them from taking the city's administrative center. Meanwhile, in Iraq, a U.S. airstrike over the weekend resulted in the death of 10 Iraqi soldiers. Defense Secretary Ash Carter called the incident, which occurred near the city of Fallujah, a, quote, mistake that involved both sides.
And now the latest news and developments from the occupied territories in Palestine from the International Middle East Media Center in Bethlehem.
Welcome to Palestine Today, a service of the International Middle East Media Center at www.imemc.org for Tuesday, December 22nd, 2015. Medical sources have reported that three Palestinians were injured on Tuesday evening after Israeli soldiers opened fire on several residents east of Al-Burej refugee camp in central Gaza. Eyewitnesses said that soldiers fired several rounds of live ammunition into the refugee camp, wounding three. Medical sources said that the three Palestinians were moved to Al-Aqsa Hospital in the central district, suffering mild to moderate wounds. On Tuesday at noon, Israeli soldiers stationed on military towers across the border fence opened fire at Palestinian farmers east of Khuza'a town, east of Khan Yunis in the southern part of the Gaza Strip, wounding one woman while working in her land. Medical sources said that the woman was moved to a local hospital suffering moderate injury. Early on Tuesday, Israeli Navy ships opened fire on Palestinian fishing boats close to Gaza shore and kidnapped 10 fishers and confiscated their boats. On Monday at night, Israeli Navy ships attacked several Palestinian fishing boats in the Beit Lahia Sea area in the northern part of the Gaza Strip and kidnapped four fishers. In the West Bank, a group of fanatic Israeli colonizers hurled on Tuesday at dawn several gas bombs into a Palestinian home in Bitello village, west of the central West Bank city of Ramallah, causing the family to suffocate. Israeli soldiers and police officers arrived at the scene, photographed the attack home, and erased graffiti and prevented the Palestinians from reaching the property. 4 months ago, a terrorist attack by a group of settlers that targeted the Dawabsha family led to immediate death of Ali Dawabsha, 18 months, while father, Saad, succumbed to wounds a week after, and the mother, Reham, died 1 month later. Only Ahmed Dawabsha, 4 years old, survived the attack and still recovering from severe burns. Also on Tuesday at dawn, the Israeli military invaded dozens of homes in different districts in the occupied West Bank and kidnapped at least 15 Palestinians, including 2 children. Moreover, on Tuesday evening, Israeli settlers from the illegal settlement of Ma'ale Luina, north of Ramallah, have destroyed 45 olive trees owned by local farmers. And that's all for today from the IMEMC News. This was the Tuesday, December 22nd, 2015 news roundup from the occupied Palestinian territories. For more news and updates, please visit our website at www.imemc.org. Today's report has been brought to you by George Ismail and me, Ghassan Bannoura.
You are listening to the KBOO Evening News. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call us with your breaking news stories at 503-231-8032. Our production team for tonight's newscast is Cliff Verla, Kristen Yount, and Jared Dantzler. The producer is Doug McVeigh. Special thanks to Michelle McQueen and Devon LaCroix. Our engineer today is Jenka Soderberg, and their KBOO Evening News and Public Affairs Director is Jenka Soderberg. A podcast of local stories from this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews, or look for us on Twitter at KBOO News. You are listening to KBOO Portland, 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath, 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River, 91.9 FM. I'm Jared Dantzler.
And I'm Robert Barncourt. Coming up tomorrow, Wednesday, December 23rd, at 7 o'clock, it'll be Democracy Now! With Amy Goodman and Juan Gonzalez. At 8, Paul Rowland will host Wednesday Talk Radio, news and commentary from local, national, and international issues. At 9, on Political Perspectives, we'll hear about an upcoming conference called Music, Nature, and Storytelling. in which participants will explore how our music, our songs, and our stories can convey the essence of what it is to be fully alive and connected with the world around us. At 10, stay tuned for Flashpoints Investigative News Radio with host Dennis Bernstein. And at 11 on the Recovery Zone, host Stephanie Potter welcomes local interfaith leaders who are promoting understanding, tolerance, peace, and human rights. Thanks to all of you KBOO members for your generous support. If you're not yet a member, please go to kboo.fm and click on Donate Today to join us. And now, we turn to the weekly commentary from Paul Cienfuegos on behalf of Community Rights and Dismantling Corporate Rule. This is presented each Tuesday on KBOO Community Radio.
Greetings. You are listening to the weekly commentary by yours truly, Paul Cienfuegos. Today is my third commentary about what I call the cancer industrial complex. Last week, I focused on what the American Cancer Society does and does not do with the almost $1 billion it raises annually. Today, I'm going to focus on the appalling history of the American Cancer Society and try to convince you that this so-called nonprofit organization, the wealthiest nonprofit in the world, is actually merely a front group for corporate America. In 1992, the Chronicle of Philanthropy reported that the ACS was, quote, more interested in accumulating wealth than in saving lives, unquote. Since then, things have only gotten worse. Here are some critical moments in the life story of the American Cancer Society, which I will refer to as ACS from now on to save a bit of time. In the 1950s, the leaders of the ACS included corporate executives from the tobacco industry. Even after massive studies provided compelling evidence linking smoking and cancer, the ACS still dragged its feet in acknowledging the link, claiming that more research was required. From the 1950s to the present, the ACS has maintained an actual committee whose purpose is to aggressively attack natural medicine alternatives to the cancer drug industry's monopoly on cancer treatments. Originally called the Committee on Quackery, it is now called the Committee on Unproven Methods of Cancer Management. In 1971, when studies unequivocally proved that DES caused vaginal cancers in teenage daughters of women administered the drug during pregnancy, the ACS refused an invitation to testify at the congressional hearing. In 1977, the ACS supported a delay in the FDA banning saccharin and even advocated its use by nursing mothers and babies. In 1977 and 78, the ACS opposed regulations being proposed for hair coloring products that contain dyes known to cause breast cancer. In 1982, the ACS decided that it would take no position at all on public health hazards until there was unequivocal human evidence of carcinogenicity. Accordingly, it rejected evidence in animal experiments and actively campaigned against laws that banned harmful food additives. In 1983, the ACS refused to join a national coalition of groups supporting the Clean Air Act. In 1984, the ACS inaugurated National Breast Cancer Awareness Month, which still happens every October. It was conceived and funded by Imperial Chemical Industries, a leading international manufacturer of petrochemicals, and by its U.S. subsidiary, Zeneca Pharmaceuticals, the sole manufacturer of tamoxifen, which is widely used for treating breast cancer. In 1992, the ACS issued a joint statement with the Chlorine Institute in support of the continued global use of organochlorine pesticides, despite clear evidence that some of these pesticides were known to cause breast cancer. In 1993, PBS broadcast a Frontline documentary on the dangers of pesticides. In response, the ACS published a memo titled Junk Science at PBS, which challenged the documentary's claim that pesticide residue in food may be at hazardous levels, and which attempted to reassure the public that carcinogenic pesticide residues in food were safe even for babies. In 1996, the ACS and other groups petitioned the Food and Drug Administration to ease restrictions on access to silicone gel breast implants, even though they knew that the implants had been shown to cause cancer in rodents. In 1997, the ACS insisted that there are no known avoidable causes of breast cancer, and that there is little except stopping smoking and reducing fat intake that any woman could do to reduce her risk. In 1998, the ACS allocated less than 1% of its then $680 million annual budget to research on environmental causes of cancer. In 1999, the ACS trivialized the risk of breast, colon, and prostate cancer from consumption of bovine growth hormone genetically modified milk, which is outlawed in much of the world. In 2002, the ACS partnered with the cosmetics industry's Look Good, Feel Better program, but failed to disclose information on the carcinogenic ingredients in the products that were donated to the unsuspecting female cancer survivors. In 2002, the ACS reassured the nation that exposure to pesticides, toxic waste in dump sites, and ionizing radiation from nuclear power plants were all at such low levels that cancer risks are negligible. The active mobilization against the ACS and its lies seems to have mostly dried up in the past decade, but Dr. Samuel Epstein continues to be the leading voice challenging this phony nonprofit organization. He's one of my heroes and a leading international expert on the environmental causes of cancer. In his own words, quote, "The approach of the ACS to cancer prevention reflects a virtually exclusive blame-the-victim philosophy. It emphasizes faulty lifestyle rather than avoidable exposure to workplace or environmental carcinogens. Giant corporations which profit handsomely while they pollute the air, water, and food with breast and other carcinogens are greatly comforted by the silence of the American Cancer Society," unquote. You can find his and other writings at these websites: the Cancer Prevention Coalition at preventcancer.com, Breast Cancer Action at bcaction.org, and the Breast Cancer Fund at breastcancerfund.org, which also lists many other related organizations. As you may have heard me say last week, I'm organizing a massive educational disruption of the American Cancer Society's annual Relay for Life in downtown Portland on May 13. I urge you to get in touch with me if you'd like to participate. You've been listening to the weekly commentary by yours truly, Paul Cienfuegos. You can hear future commentaries every Tuesday on the KBOO Evening News in Portland, Oregon, and on a growing number of other radio stations. I welcome your feedback. You can subscribe to my weekly podcast via iTunes or at communityrightspdx.org. You can sign up for my community rights updates at paulcienfuegos.com. You can follow me on Twitter at @CNFuegosPaul. Thanks for listening, and remember, we are the people we've been waiting for.
KBOO News In Depth, where we take a deeper look at the top news stories impacting our community.
The Klamath River Agreements and the Klamath Basin Restoration Agreement, which took years of work to bring together Klamath tribes, farmers, fishermen, power companies, is about to be destroyed by Congress. The agreement, which addresses water rights along the Klamath Basin, has been hailed by some and criticized by others. For more, we spoke with two people entrenched in the ongoing struggle, Jim McCarthy of Oregon Water Watch and Tom Schlosser, an attorney for the Hoopa Valley Tribe. This is Jared Dantzler for KBOO News. I'm here speaking with Jim McCarthy, Communication Director at Water Watch of Oregon. Pacific Core, the owner of the four hydroelectric dams, is now seeking to relicense the dams, whereas before, during the agreement, it seemed they were willing to remove the dams. But now with the relicensing, what is your view?
Yeah, it's not clear what's going to happen. I mean, there's a number of different scenarios. So what are known as the Klamath Agreements are actually three agreements. So the Klamath Basin Restoration Agreement, which is the core water agreement that was the architecture was laid under the Bush administration. And that is going to expire in January and hopefully will go away and we can move on to more productive endeavors in the Klamath. There's also the Upper Basin Comprehensive Agreement, which is agreement that actually is the only agreement that actually has demand reduction in it. It reduces demand for water in the basin above the lake by 30,000 acre feet. So that improves the flows in the streams above the lake for fish that are struggling there. And it's an agreement between the local irrigators up there and the tribes. Now, the problem with that agreement is it's connected to the larger agreement, the Klamath Basin Restoration Agreement, which actually, once the water comes downstream into the lake, the Klamath Basin Restoration Agreement would take even more water out of the lake and give it to the Klamath irrigators and leave the salmon in the Klamath River to die. So it's our hope that some modification of the Upper Basin Comprehensive Agreement between the Klamath tribes and their neighbors can live on. And it's also our hope that some modification of the Klamath Hydropower Settlement Agreement, which is the agreement between PacifiCorp and other settlement parties, which involves guarantees of funding for dam removal. And those guarantees are $200 million from a trust fund created in Oregon and California from surcharges on PacifiCorp customers in both those states. That trust fund's around $100 million now, but it's supposed to go to $200 million. There's also $200 million available in the California Water Bond, which was recently passed. So there's $400 million for the dam removal, and that's more than double what some estimates have come in for the dam removal. And so the funding for the dam removal was never needed to come from Congress. There's already